Welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Gallegos, and welcome back. This episode is going to be part two of the interview with Jeff Braleo. So we're literally just going to dive in to right where we left off in the conversation on part one. If you guys haven't checked that out, go back and check out part one of the interview with Jeff Braleo. He's an attorney here in Utah, and he's sharp as a tack when it comes to creative financing. He does this all day long, every day for his client base here in Utah. And if you're looking for an attorney here, he's definitely highly recommended from both Jeff and I. And reach out to him, guys. If you need any kind of legal work done regarding real estate or setting up asset protection, he's your guy, and definitely anything with creative finance. So without further ado, we're gonna get back into it. Enjoy, guys. Thanks.
There's a lot of things you want in a seller financing deal. So you should use a good contract designed specifically for seller financing.
Can you give a couple of quick examples of what you would want to add into something contracts.
Essentially, not only the acknowledgement of the due on sale clause, but what's to happen if it is called due.
Okay.
So typically it's going to be the buyer's responsibility.
Yep.
But I've seen things where it reverts back to the seller.
Depending on the situation, I may not be able to do anything. And now it reverts back to the seller because the loan's still in the seller's name.
Right.
Yeah.
And you tell the bank, okay, yeah, we'll just give the house back to the seller.
Yeah.
So due on sale acknowledgement of what the ramifications of it. I think I wrote some of these down. This might sound so basic, but taking into account taxes and insurance.
Sure.
I actually litigated a case and won for a borrower who the seller, it was note and deed. The seller wrote the note and deed, you know, some amount, you know, and then an interest rate and a fixed payment of $1,000 a month. Well, that was fine for the first 3 years when the seller's mortgage payment was $900 a month. She'd make $100 a month.
Yep.
But then over time, that
taxes have
tax
gone
insurance
up.
And have gone up. And suddenly she's losing money, and she was trying to strong-arm my clients into paying more. And I'm like, no, you wrote the note and deed.
Right.
It's fixed. It doesn't take that into account. So taking the tax and insurance account, HOAs or other monthly fees that may be associated with remembering those things because they have to be involved. The difference between late fees and default needs to be very clear.
Yeah.
And these go in the contract. So when you create either like a note and deed, the seller's already agreed to all the terms of the seller financing, because the seller financing is a sale of the property and it's some kind of note and deed. So you need to make sure that all those note and deed terms is discussed and negotiated up front. Otherwise, and I've had this happen, you know, sellers will come to closing and I'll be explaining documents, are like, what? I didn't know that. What? And then I sit there for an hour and a half, essentially closing the deal on behalf of my guys. And I call them the investor. I'm like, dude,
you owe me.
You owe me. Yeah, I was your partner. I was your partner on that. I locked that one down.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and you would have saved me an hour of conversations if you explained this up front. Because if you're making monthly payments on anything, whether it's a rent or a mortgage, you know, there's the late fees, but then there's a default.
Yeah.
And what are the terms of default? And when is it in default? Standard mortgage is 30 days. So you have 30 days where you just have to pay a late fee.
Yep.
But that 30-day mark, you're technically in default. Mortgage company, the bank may not do anything at that point, but you're in default. But we've done notes and deeds, especially when you're representing the investor, where default doesn't occur for maybe 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, so you can actually be 3 months late, and you're just paying late fees, but you're not technically in default.
Yeah.
So there's a difference. closing costs and negotiate seller financing deals, because a lot of seller financing deals, like, you know, they're promising their seller, you know, you'll walk with $5,000 and I'll cover your closing
costs. $5,000 down payment.
Yeah. Or $5,000, you know, however you describe it. But then they don't realize that you know, there may be tax preparations, there may be assessments that come out of the seller's $5,000. If the seller comes to closing and there's utilities on there that we, you know, the title company has to pay off to clear, and the seller goes, no, he promised me $5,000.
Right. Okay? Yep.
And on the contract, it said the buyer would pay closing costs.
Yeah.
But taxes and insurance aren't closing costs.
And back utility costs.
Yes. So there's other things that go under those settlement statements. So understanding the settlement statement. But if you get that into the contract, that the buyer will, you know, depending on what your deal is, you know, the buyer will pay taxes and assessments. You know, there could be a million liens on the property. That's a big one in seller financing. You've got to understand what liens there are.
Yeah.
You might negotiate a great deal, you get that title report back, and suddenly there's six judgments and a divorce and alimony. And that throws your numbers off.
Yeah.
Because suddenly you've got $40,000 in debt that the seller didn't disclose to you that you're going to have to deal with.
Somehow it's funny, they have this short-term memory with that.
Yeah.
Like they've, what? Yeah. I don't know anything about that.
I don't remember that one.
And if your seller's filed a bankruptcy, and again, you should have that conversation. And ask them, have you ever filed for bankruptcy?
Because
they won't tell you unless you ask.
Yeah.
No one wants to admit that.
Yeah.
And if they have, don't expect them to understand it. No person that I've ever seen in 15 years seller has understood what their bankruptcy was, what it cleared, and what it didn't clear.
It's funny
they
that
think,
way.
Yeah, they think they did this bankruptcy so that everything is gone.
Right.
But oh no, that's not exactly true. And so you think it's all been cleared up, but then you go to close and there's other things that you now have to deal with.
Yep.
So anytime there's a bankruptcy involved, understand you're going to need more time. Because they're going to have to go back to their BK lawyer. You're going to have to find out exactly what was cleared, and you may need letters from the court or that attorney or the trustee before you can sell the house.
Yep.
So it's a little side note.
Well, and a couple that I like to add in are a balloon payment. So what the amount will be due in a certain amount of time, so that at least then if things are paid off early, that we can figure it out based on where it would have been if it went to term.
Yeah.
So I liked having that number in there so that there's no discrepancy.
Right.
And second would be the escalation of taxes. That, hey, taxes
and
go
who's
up.
Covering
yeah,
that.
Exactly. It's like, I'm sorry, your payment's changing. Well, why? Because the taxes went up and you're now the owner. So you pay for the taxes.
Yeah.
I don't control that. That's something that you're responsible for.
Yeah. And then, again, the discussion, because I've actually had a client who, I saw that in his paperwork. I knew it. Like, he was the investor. The seller was giving him a fixed rate and term. So his payment would have been fixed for the 5 years before the balloon payment. And his payment didn't go up if taxes and insurance went up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And I brought that to his attention, because he's a sophisticated investor, and I brought that to his attention. He's like, yeah, but that's a better deal for me.
Uh-oh.
I said, yes, but
your seller's going to have a problem.
The seller's going to have a problem with it. The seller's going to be upset, which you don't want. The seller could get a lawyer. The seller could call the bank, you know, if there's another mortgage. So, again, it's that fraud thing that I always come back to. I mean, you be honest, explain things well, ask the right questions, and that alone will solve 90% of the problems you would run into.
Right.
You know, and one of the
and
things,
you get it all in advance.
One of the things, and it's interesting, is that, you know, people go a lot off how you explain creative financing, and then they don't read every line. You know, they expect that the way that you explained it is the way it is going to happen, and so be clear, because
and honest.
I mean, yeah, because it's fairly easy to deceive someone based on putting together these kind of terms deals. But is that really what you want? Because somewhere down the road, it's going to be a problem for you.
It's going to come back to you.
I mean,
karma's a bitch.
Tell them the way it is. Be honest.
Yeah.
That way, if there is a problem, they're willing to work with you rather than be totally irritated
with
you.
No deal is worth misleading somebody.
I would agree.
For sure.
Because if it does come back around, it's going to cost you far more than that deal ever got you.
That's where it falls in the lines of fraud.
Yeah, I like sleeping well at night.
Yeah, I agree.
And, I really
and you
do.
Know what? People, for the most part, most people welcome it.
Yeah, they
welcome
absolutely.
The honesty.
Absolutely.
They'd rather know, one, that you're being honest with them, and two, that, hey, you've got their best interest in mind, rather than, are they going to screw me? How many different ways is this person going
to
screw
me? And a common newbie that I heard, like, oh, I don't want to say that to my seller because, you know, that might scare me and back out of the deal. I said, no, go talk to very experienced investors. These are the conversations they do have. It's never a problem. If you explain it clearly and correctly, and you're honest with them and you explain how it really works, they will actually more likely, and because they're full more comfortable with you, that you're actually being honest with them.
Yeah.
So,
well, and here's the balance, at least in my opinion, is that when you're negotiating with the seller about, hey, here's how I can buy your property, I'm going to give you this down, this amount a month, blah, blah, blah. Okay, now's not the time to throw in, well, have you filed bankruptcy? let me tell you about the due on sale clause. Blah, 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 blah. Keep talking. And that's not the time. Here's my offer. Great. Okay, does that sound like it's something that's going to work for you? Great. Let's talk about some of the details now.
Yeah.
And now go into it rather than throw it all out at them and say, so what do you want to do?
Yeah. And that's where we should do some podcasts. I don't negotiate a lot with sellers. I haven't in probably 15 years.
Yep.
I'm now technically what you call a wholesale buyer.
Yep.
Yeah, I do the easy route. I don't knock doors or talk to sellers anymore. So, but yeah, how you talk to sellers, again, those are great topics that I'm not competent to speak on, but you are. you do it honestly and explain it clearly. You're going to lock the deal in an honest way as opposed to not disclosing things and then always worrying, if they find out, what happens if this happens?
I want the seller to like me.
Yeah.
That's important to me. And I want them to write me a testimonial. And I want them to...
They'll stay in contact with you long term in case something does happen. You know where you can find them.
And I want them to be able to say to their friend, hey, Jeff really helped me. You should talk to him.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, all right. A couple more things. Okay. I don't want to take up all your time. I know you've got to go renovate your house today. So let's kind of back up. You mentioned lease options. Let's talk a little bit about what your thoughts are with them. I agree. There's a niche. And it's not just here in Utah. It's probably in a lot of different markets across the country is that people just don't use these very often.
Right.
And I like them. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah. No, I really like them. It's going to take a seller that understands it, because if you own the property and you want to lease option it out, that's one thing as an investor, because you're used to being a landlord, you kind of thing. But if you're the buyer in a seller financing and they don't want to sell the house, maybe they're too scared, you're not going to make their mortgage payment. They can't get over that hurdle, and they're worried about their credit. Then you say, well, look, you know, we've got another option. You know, you can keep the house, you'll own it. I will be a tenant, you'll be a landlord. I know that might scare you a little bit if you've never been a landlord, you know, but you can say, I'm a real estate investor, I have 20 rental properties, I'm an experienced landlord, and so I'm willing to rent your house at this amount, which will cover your mortgage. You can go through escrow specialists if you want to make sure that your rent payment goes to pay the mortgage. Even though you don't own the house, I still like it. But the seller's going to get out of their house, out of whatever problems they're facing, but they're going to have the comfort of owning it and receiving a monthly payment. And then you get it under lease, and then you turn around and lease it out.
Sublease it. Yep.
And so what I kind of want to bring up here is when you're a buyer under a lease option, you want the lease and the option to buy as two separate documents.
Sure.
Okay? Take it back. Back that up. As a buyer, you want one document. Because as a buyer, you don't want to be a victim.
Oh, right. Yes, you are correct.
Yes.
Yep.
And to explain that, because people listening may not quite get that. When you go to an eviction, you have to provide... Every eviction goes through a court. Here in Utah, we can do it in a couple of weeks, but it still goes before a judge. I mean, some people think that there's no judge involved as a matter of process. But no, it goes in front of a judge, and you have to present the lease or the document that you're evicting the person on. So if you present to the judge a lease option where it's the lease and your right to buy the house, the judge is going to see the option and go, wait a minute, you have some equitable rights in this house. We can't just evict you.
Yep.
Okay? Which as a buyer you want. You want to be out of the house. You want them to jump through a lot of hoops to get rid of you. But now that you have the lease option and you're going to try and sublease it to a tenant, then you want it in two separate documents. You want a standard lease agreement, just like you do with any other rental property you own, and then give them a separate document to the option. That way, if your tenants don't pay rent, you submit just the lease agreement to the judge, and that's all he's going to see, and he's going to push through the eviction, and you can get your tenant out of there.
I've actually been doing exactly that since I very first started back in 2000. And it's never been an issue for me because almost every tenant that I've ever had to evict doesn't show up.
Yeah, they
don't do anything.
Yeah. Do you recommend filing a notice of interest on title as the buyer, evidencing
Yes. And in that option agreement or lease option, if it's the one, again, right in that paragraph, even though a lease option does grant you an interest in land, and I think it fully justifies a notice of interest on the property. If that sentence is in there, that this lease option creates an interest in land and the seller the owner authorizes the buyer, the tenant to record a notice of interest, then you're solid.
Well, and I think that's an absolute must in that, because if I'm the buyer, if I'm leasing your house, Jeff, with the option to buy, and you owe $100,000, I don't want you to go borrow another $150,000 if I've got an option to buy it for two.
Right. So, which is an interesting side note to seller financing, to back up, always look at HELOCs.
Yeah.
People don't look at HELOCs the same way as they look at mortgages. If you're going to buy a property subject to a mortgage and a second, make sure you freeze that HELOC.
Yep.
Because otherwise, the borrower, the seller, can continue to take out cash out of your property.
Yep.
How can you freeze that?
Go to the bank.
Okay.
They can go to the bank. The borrower can go to the bank and say, "Hey, I just want to convert my HELOC into a rate and term," which they'll fix a rate, they'll fix a term, they'll fix a monthly payment, and then you, as obviously the buyer, know what that payment's going to be that you're taking subject to.
Yep.
Okay. Great point.
So.
Yep. Back to the lease options.
but
that was a great point. And you've always got to keep track of those lines of credit on a property. But on a lease option, so I've never liked doing the sublease. And here's the reason why I've never liked it, is that I've never really figured out the great way to secure my interest in the property. For instance, if I'm lease optioning your house for $100 and I go and find a new person for $130, I'm collecting the difference in rents per month, right? I'm getting some money up front, but I have some money coming to me if my tenant buyer exercises their option.
Mm-hmm.
But I show nowhere on title.
Right.
So how do I secure my interest at, B, which is, how I get paid on the back end? I've just never loved how I would have to go about doing it. I have some ideas of how to do
it. How you secure your sort of cash from your tenant buyer?
My equity that my tenant buyer will pay me if they exercise their option. So, because I agreed to pay you $100, mm-hmm. they agreed to pay me $130, minus whatever I might have collected up front. So I'm still due. Maybe it's $25,000. So if my tenant buyer goes and exercises their option, I'm not on title. It's you.
Right.
So that money would really go to you unless I show up at title and say, wait.
It's a great point, because that's the one, the final sale, the final exercise of the option becomes the issue. The interim is really great. For a monthly spread of money and monthly income, and technically you're not on title. Now, you are a landlord. You do need landlord's insurance, and you can get your own separate landlord's policy on the property.
Right.
And you want to buy in your entity and do all the things you would do as a landlord. But when it comes time to sell the house, there's a couple of ways to do it. None of which are great, to be honest. You're going to have to go into a purchase contract. You could do essentially a double close. Problem with that is the kind of financing your buyer's getting. If they're getting a conventional loan, you won't be able to do a double close because you're going to have to season title.
Which almost no matter, almost all the time they would be getting.
Most likely, yeah. Yes, you're going to be getting the conventional loan.
Right.
You could buy it, you could exercise your option early.
And buy it.
And buy it for the last 6 months that your tenants are in there.
But now I've got to go get either a hard money loan or a conventional loan.
You could go under contract with the seller and assign the contract for an assignment fee for your equity spread.
Okay.
The risk, the tough thing there
is if my buyer doesn't perform.
Well, if your buyer doesn't perform, you evict your buyer and keep their deposit, their option funds.
Right.
Correct. But what I'm saying, if part of what you just brought up is what I love about lease options, mm-hmm. is I love to assign them, like wholesale them,
mm-hmm.
Create the deal with the seller, go find the tenant buyer, collect that option
at the
deposit.
Time.
Yeah.
And then you're done. Yeah, I like that too.
But what the issue that I've always seen is staying in the middle and getting paid at the end. And so I'd much rather buy it on creative financing, owner financing, any which way it may be, sell it on lease option. Now I'm on that title. They owe me. I'm renting it. Now it's not an issue with me getting paid. I was just wondering if you had any... I've heard about where you actually go to the seller. I hate this idea, by the way. You go to the seller and say, look, you know what I'm doing. I'm lease optioning your property. I'm going to sublet it. I'm going to be the one that manages it. You have nothing to do with
just
it.
Just collect your check every month.
Yeah, you got nothing to do with it. I'm going to get this amount of money when it's all said and done. I want to place a new trust deed and note to protect my interest on the property. That way, when it closes, I get paid. Now, the seller knows...
So your worry is that your tenant buyer doesn't perform.
No, my worry is my tenant buyer does perform, but I don't get paid.
How would you not get paid?
So let's map this out for a second. So I come to you and I say, Jeff, I really like your property. I'd like to rent it with the option to buy. You say, great. And you say, I want $100,000 for my property. Not very realistic these days, but let's use easy numbers. Okay, and yeah, you know, I'm going to pay you $800 a month in rent, and I have a 2-year term. Okay, pretty standard. And then I go and I find Jonathan. Jonathan's like, oh, I'd love this house. I'm like, great, I'll sublet it to you for $125. Mm-hmm. With $5,000 down as option deposit with $1,000 a month, okay? 2-year term.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the $5,000 now. I'm happy. I'm getting $200 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Now Jonathan's 2-year term is up and says, yep, I'm ready to exercise my option. Great. Now,
your work is the equity spread technically would have to go to the seller.
Correct. I'm nowhere in the middle to protect myself. And Jonathan doesn't have to go call me and tell me, hey, I'm going to exercise my option. He can just literally go down and say, I've met with a lender. And if he doesn't contact me, who's the title company going to contact?
He would have to do an end around you and go directly to the seller to get a purchase contract, though. That's the only way he could buy the house without you.
Okay, so that might help.
Yes. So there's really no way for him to present a contract to the title company unless he's got the seller's signature on it, I suppose he could look up title, find their address, or talk to them, but,
unrealistic.
A little unrealistic.
Notice of interest is the absolute must.
The notice of interest can do it. So you can do the notice of interest or you can do an assignment. Just write that into when you do the purchase contract with the seller, that there's an assignment fee to you for your equity amount. The one issue with that, though, is in a conventional loan, how banks look at that fee and whether they will cover that in the mortgage, which a lot won't.
Yeah.
So your tenant buyer is going to have the cash.
Yeah.
You can get it at closing, but they're going to have to come up with the cash. They won't be able to finance the mortgage, which could be tough.
Yeah, most of these people won't have that.
I don't mind the note and deed, because a note and deed, when 2 years down the road, that just becomes like a second mortgage that the seller has to pay off.
Yeah, and that's probably,
And it, maybe, again, it can be an open-ended note. It doesn't have to have a specific number on it. It could literally list in that note, you know, the difference between my original purchase price of $100,000 with me and the purchase price to Jonathan, whatever that difference is the amount of my note.
And I guess, yeah, it probably would work if you had this conversation up front with the seller. It's like, look, I'm going to eventually bring, you know, a trust deed and note to be placed on the property. It's just going to be what I'm getting paid. You're going to get everything I told you you're going to get.
Right.
All right. Now I've talked to Jonathan. He's ready to buy. Now I go back to the seller and say, okay, here's my $20,000 trust deed and note. Now you can close. Jonathan can close with you. And I just get paid as a trustee. No,
yeah,
that would work.
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's good conversation with your seller.
Yeah,
good documents prepared by a lawyer, and even encourage your seller to have the documents reviewed by their attorney.
Yeah,
that way, you know, the two attorneys. It's always easier when two attorneys talk because we speak the same language. And
I always felt like that was a bad idea.
Yeah, you know, it can depend on the attorney. There are some idiot attorneys out there, but generally, when I'm dealing directly with, I'm representing a client, and I'm dealing directly with the other party, I get much further when I deal with another lawyer because they're usually more rational.
Yeah.
But doing that will help your seller feel comfortable that the note indeed really is for your equity. It's not for something else. You're not going to foreclose, or you know. And again, as long as those documents are drafted correctly, and then you're okay.
It is a little tricky.
It would be. Yeah, it's definitely a little trickier. It's not your just standard note indeed that you have a form for that you could just go do. And no, I would definitely have an attorney draft that one.
Yeah, and just to clarify, you're talking about doing this up front.
Right? Yeah. Yes, up front with your seller, so when you're doing the lease option. Explain this is how I'm going to, you know, make it easy. You don't even say to protect yourself. Because when you turn around and it's always the sale on the back end that's going to cause the problems.
Right.
And say, to solve that problem, since I'm not going to be the seller of the house in 2 years, I got to figure out some way for that equity, you know, that we've negotiated and you've agreed to, of actually getting it at closing.
Right.
And the easiest way to do it is just have a note that's paid off.
Cool. Have you done these transactions then?
I've never done it with a note. I've done lease options, but not with a note.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's a great way, though.
Yeah.
Well, that secures your interest.
Yeah, the only problem is that now the seller will know what you're making, which isn't ideal, depending on how, you know, the conversation that you have.
Yeah, and it's going to depend on market conditions and a number of other things, but you can just say, look, I'm going to buy it for you, like Jeff Rappaport's going to buy from Jeff Braylier for $100,000, and then Rappaport says, you know, I'm going to keep this for three years. You know, are you okay with that? I say, yeah, I'm totally okay with that. You're going to pay me every month for 3 years? Jeff Roberts says, yes, I'm going to pay you every month. Awesome, I get my income. But in 3 years, this house is going to be worth more. I'm going to do a little bit of rehab on it, fix it up, and there's going to be a bigger equity spread, and I might sell it for 130. I might sell it for 140. Who knows, because it depends on the market. But the difference between the 100 and whatever I sell it for is mine. I think a seller is going to understand that. You think?
I think, but...
they know the house is going to go up in 3-4 years.
Yeah, there are sellers that we talk to daily that absolutely know 100% that we're wholesaling their property and they don't care.
Yeah.
I don't go and tell them how much money we're making. They may care. I don't know. Some might. Some probably don't.
But at least wouldn't they expect you to... sell? I mean, if you say you're going to sublease it out and assign that option,
they
have to expect that you're going to make a profit.
Well, and they all know that we're investors, so they know that we're in this to make money, but it does become sometimes a fine line with how much money do you make.
Yeah.
So if you're making $30,000 on this lease option over the course of 2 years, seller now is like, why am I not getting some of that? And so it can become an issue. Yeah. I don't love when my seller knows how much I'm making. I don't care that my buyer knows.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's a bigger issue in wholesaling.
Yeah.
Because it's immediate. Like, I'm going to turn around and make $30,000 tomorrow.
Right.
On this house, as opposed to $30,000 two or three years down the road. It's also a risk that you may only make $102,000 3 years if the market crashes.
Right.
And that's a risk, and you're not going to make any money.
Right. But also that, you know, if you're entering into a lease option with the seller, that there's no guarantee that they will actually sell that house in 2 years, 3 years either. So,
And you've made, you know, if your tenant buyers end up not buying it at all,
right.
You've made their option fee of $5,000, $10,000, whatever that yep. is, and some little bit of income during the interim.
Right.
And if you just give the house back to your sellers, you know, at least you eat $5,000 and some $100 a month. Better than a kick in the head.
As long as the house comes back in as good, if not yes. better condition
and
as it was.
That's better landlording. That's how right. That's right. How to be a better landlord.
That's right. So as much as I do like lease options, I'd rather me personally, and yeah. this is, I don't love the subletting. I'd rather own it and then lease option it or wholesale it.
Yeah.
It would be one
honestly,
of those two.
I'm with you on that. Ownership is everything. You own it, you control it. And you know, and it's what we're used to doing. Like, if you're going to be a landlord, you know how to be a good landlord, the right insurance, the right entities, you know, doing things the right way, and you can really minimize a lot of those risks.
Yep.
Yeah, so I like ownership.
Yeah.
Which is why I like the all-inclusive as opposed to
yeah.
because I just, ownership is power to me.
Well, and what one last point, and then I've got yeah. a couple quick last questions for you, but one of the other things that, and this is a rule, I swear I learned this, the first month that I got into real estate investing, you do not fix up a property you do not own. So do not start going to do work on a property that you are leasing with the option to buy. That's a problem waiting to happen. So if you're going to do any work to a property, own it. Otherwise, don't do the work. So maybe it's becomes more of like a work for equity type situation if the property needs work, but you don't want to do that work. You're now at risk for losing that money.
And to caveat off that, don't let your tenants do it either. The reason being is if you let your tenants who are in that option, because they have an option to buy it too, right? Because you just assigned the lease option to them. So they're thinking one day we're going to own this house. This is going to be our house. So we're going to fix it up. We're going to update it. We're going to paint it because we're going to live in it one day. When you allow your tenants to make improvements like that to the property, you're giving them equitable rights in the house, and it'll make it much more difficult to evict them if they don't comply with the terms of lease.
Nope.
So that's one of our, when we teach lease options, the red flags and things to avoid, that's definitely one of them. Do not let your tenants do any improvements on the property.
Absolutely.
All right, I'm going to come off the topic again, but I could easily just sit here and talk to you for 3 hours.
That's why I like you so much.
Yeah, it's great. So I wanted to talk to you about, because you lead like a lobbying effort here locally, mm-hmm. but it's going on all over the country for sure. And I just want to get your take on it, because I read all these posts, and I am scared for new investors out there, because they are, I don't know if they're experienced investors giving them advice, but it is poor. And it is regarding the legalities of wholesaling and what you can and cannot do to maintain the legality of it.
Yeah.
So give me a little insight of what you've been doing.
Let's back up real quick and just explain what that problem is, what the issue is that people are having across
the issue. The legal issue, other than typical real estate legal issues with contract stuff, in wholesaling is, are you representing a seller and negotiating with a buyer in a sale transaction?
Are you brokering a deal?
Are you brokering a deal? You know, are you putting a buyer and a seller together? It's very similar in lending laws. If you, in Utah, in another topic, if you're a private lender and or you're putting a lender with a borrower, you're acting as a mortgage broker, and you need a license to put a borrower and lender together. Same thing with real estate. If you're putting a seller together with a buyer, technically you are brokering that sales transaction, which would require a real estate license in order to do. With wholesaling, what's technically going on from a legal standpoint is the buyer is, The investor is going under contract with a property, so is the named buyer and will just buy that property. But instead of him buying the property, he's going to assign the contract to another investor who's actually going to buy it and maybe flip it or keep it as a rental property for an assignment fee. So it's a contractual, what's really happening is you're assigning a contract to somebody else. You're not selling a property to somebody else.
Right.
The problem arises in how the Division of Real Estate views that transfer of the contract to your wholesale buyer. You'll probably need to bring me back in a couple of months.
Yeah.
It has gotten a little ugly, actually. A client sent me a letter from the division just this last week for wholesaling, $25,000 fine.
Wow.
6 month suspension from his license, which is his livelihood.
So this is a licensed realtor.
This is a licensed.
Okay.
So this is someone who already with a license.
So I'm clear, there are issues for both
licensed
realtors
and non-licensed.
And non-licensed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And what is the impetus for all of this is the wholesaling is now the new hot thing in real estate.
Yes.
Everybody wants to be a wholesaler. They're all taking wholesaling courses. They're all jumping in the game. They're doing mass marketing. They're all trying to be big wholesalers because they can see the money involved. 99% of them don't know what they're doing. They're doing it wrong. They're taking too many risks. They're just jumping in with both feet. The Division of Real Estate has seen this. Well, brokers, real estate brokers have seen this.
Yeah.
The brokers are upset that people are engaged in real estate without running it through their system.
Yeah, they don't have control.
They don't have control, so they call up the division. They say, these people are doing this. You need to shut it down. And here in Utah, our laws and our division are highly controlled by by real estate brokers.
Which is not unusual all across
the country. No, because the real estate brokers are big, strong lobbies in every single state and nationally.
Yep.
They're just big lobbyists. And so it's not unusual. And Utah's laws, license laws, are very broad, they're very vague, and the division has a lot of latitude in how they apply the licensing statutes. Right now with licensed agents, they're looking at what forms are you using, they're looking at disclosures of your agency, they're looking at did you get authorization from the seller to market the property. Which is an issue. This is the complaint that I just read 3 days
ago.
That's
interesting.
And I looked at that and I went, they're not marketing the property, they're marketing the contract. So that's going to be a big area of discussion over the next few months is
what's the difference?
What's the difference between selling the contract and selling the real estate?
Yeah. Which is an issue
all over the country. A year ago when I talked to the division, they seem to think as long as you're just selling the contract, you're not marketing a property by saying, you know, it's a great location, it's a great view, you know, and getting out like things that real estate agents would do, you would be fine. In the last 12 months, and I think it's pressure from brokers and it's pressure from higher ups at the division, the investigators, I'm thinking they are going to try and attempt to prevent even a transfer of contract. They're going to restrict the marketing of that contract so heavily that you just won't be able to market your contract because anything, any reference to the house itself, they're going to say you're selling real estate, you need a license.
That's ridiculous.
I know. So there's the marketing aspect. Here's the big one. It was the disclosure of the fee to the seller.
Yeah, they want full disclosure,
Disclosure of the fee you're making to the seller. Now, most investors don't care that the buyer knows. In fact, it's pretty much stated on the assignment, and I'm making $30,000 on the assignment. The way the division looks at that is if that's what a market value for the house is, that $30,000 should go to the seller or at least disclose to the seller that that's what's being made, because here's what happened, not to this specific client, but to another one who was brought into the division. Because the division told me, he's like, they're going to these sellers saying, hey, you don't need to fix up your house, you don't need to bring anybody through it, and you're going to save the 6% commission. And then the wholesaler turns around and makes it bigger than a 6% commission.
Sure.
And so the division is kind of looking at that as fraud, and I don't agree with that, and you're shaking your head. But they're saying, so you're going to save $12,000. And the seller's like, okay, you know, that's fine. But then you make $30,000 as a wholesaler, that extra $18,000, in the complaint that I just saw 3 days ago, they called that essentially stealing the seller's equity.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And my argument is the seller negotiated a fair price as long as that investor didn't commit fraud.
Yeah.
I've been upfront with the division. I said, if you catch anybody lying to sellers, I will personally go after them. I will do it for you.
But I know these guys and I know these wholesalers. They're not lying. They're just in there negotiating a deal like any investor would do.
Yeah.
They could buy it, and if they wanted to flip it themselves, they would make 100% of the profits.
Right.
But they don't want to spend the time doing that.
Yep.
So they wholesale it, they cut the that profit in half, they take half, and then the flipper gets half. So really, there's the wholesaler's taking the equity from their buyer.
Correct. And
not from the seller. But the division is, and I think it's because there's so many new investors that are probably pushing the limits of honesty.
Yep.
Not doing it with legal good documents, and the division is afraid that the public is being defrauded. That's the key. When the division thinks the public's being defrauded, they're going to jump in and start shutting things down.
Well, here's the interesting part to me, and I want to clarify a couple things right after this, but the fee that a wholesaler makes is really not based, I mean, it's based on what you're able to negotiate with a seller. But it's really about the buyers that you have. I mean, to be honest, most of the buyers do not come from you putting an ad on Craigslist.
No.
And it's about buyers that you have built up over time that are rehabbers or buy and hold or people that understand what it is that they need to do with a particular property, not the general public.
Right.
So that's kind of the thing that I think keeps getting lost in all this is that wholesalers have good wholesalers.
Yes, the good ones.
Good. They have...
That buyer network.
They have a network. So typically when a seller is using a wholesaler, they need a quick sale.
Uh-huh. Or they need cash quick.
Right.
They're underwater, they're going to lose it to a foreclosure.
They always, always, always still have the option of going and listing it with a realtor. Always. They've chosen not to.
That's right.
So, and now that wholesaler's job is to figure out a way that, hey, what you need is what I can give you and then make it happen, which is, you know, I think where a lot of wholesaling is falling short right now is that people are going in promising things that they just can't deliver.
Yeah.
So, two things.
And misrepresenting the transaction.
Yeah. So there's two things that I'm curious about, because this is how I understand the two biggest issues to be, is it's that marketing piece where, and I only look at it from investor because I'm not licensed and have no intent on getting licensed anytime soon. And then the second part is the actual intent to buy.
Yes, and that's the other one is, the division is saying these guys are doing so much wholesaling that they never intended to buy, which means they were essentially fraudulent in their communications with the seller that they were going to buy this house. Which is why, now I've got licensed agents who are wholesalers who have been investigated and come out clean.
Sure.
So it is really important to disclose, not only verbally when you're communicating with the seller, but in writing, in the documents, that it is your intent to either buy or wholesale it, sign the contract, and you intend to make a profit, and that profit may come in, you know, from a flip or may come from a wholesale fee, and that the seller understands that none of that profit goes to the seller. That's an investment side thing, and the seller, you know, has entered into this contract freely and without duress, and that goes a long way to helping. It's disclosure, like disclose.
Yep.
So disclose it. And I think the disclosure can get you around a lot of that, the kind of the fraud issue. It's gonna be marketing.
The contract. Not
marketing
the
contract, yeah, which I think right now we've been so deep with licensed agents because that's who they're going after now. We haven't even talked about how non-licensed people are going to do it, but I got a feeling the division right now, their perspective is they're going to be so restrictive on the marketing that they're basically going to shut it down. But you're going to need a license to do it. So not that fee, but then running the fee through the broker. So if you're a licensed agent, and most, which is just dumb. I mean, most brokers or a lot of brokers will allow their agents to do side deals and act as a principal. Yep. So the position the division is taking, one, it's really a violation of due process because it is kind of a usurpation of power that they're playing the decider in whose equity that is.
Right.
You know? And then the third one popped out of my head, but
Yeah, it's just, it's going to be a tough battle. It's going to be a tough battle.
One last question, just because I know we've got to wrap this up, mm-hmm. is that, and I used to do this myself. I don't do it anymore. But some of the intent issues with a contract is, you know, put down $10 earnest money.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Hey, you have equitable interest in the property because you signed a contract. So you're allowed to go market the property. I mean, these things are not true. And whoever's listening to this, you will find, even if you've been getting away with it, you will run into a problem. And you do not want to run into this problem because it's getting worse. In Florida right now, if you are acting as a broker without a license, it's a felony. Ohio, I believe, it's a felony. I know of a case in Ohio where a wholesaler was marketing a property he did not own and did not have a license to do so, got brought into the division. They went back and looked at how many deals he had done with no intent of buying.
Right.
284 of them, charged him $1,000 per each one, $284,000 fine. So it's happening over the country, and it's something that you've got to be aware of.
Yeah, the suggestion now has been, I've always told wholesalers, buy a good number of the properties you actually negotiate and go into contract with, because then you can show some evidence that yes, you do in fact buy properties.
Yeah, it's sometimes not your business just to assign.
That's right. So you do have an intent to buy it. Sometimes you buy it. Sometimes it's just better to not.
Put up a decent earnest money.
Do it a legitimate transaction. And the other thing we're saying is now is I think we're going to end up in a double close.
Which is actually buy the property for a minute and immediately resell it.
Immediately resell it.
Which is what Jeff Watson recommends already.
Yeah, I know Jeff. We speak often.
Yeah. So, who is the attorney for the National REIA?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And actually, he's the one that pointed out the $284,000 fine in Ohio. So, all right, great. Yeah. Well, first of all, I appreciate your lobbying efforts.
Sure thing.
One of the things that I really hate about the wholesaling and the statutes, they're very gray.
Totally.
Very, very gray. And it seems like the states use them how they see
how they
fit.
Want. And they treat every case differently.
Yeah,
So there's, you know, for the last year, I've been trying to get them. You know, I'm like, I can talk to the wholesalers. I can get them in compliance, but I need to know what to tell them.
Yeah,
what and is a year compliance? Later, I things have changed over the last year. So I don't know what to tell anybody, because I'll tell you, do it this way, you'll be fine, and then you're not fine because the division just changed their mind.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I right now the bigger, I'm like, buy a lot of your, or just buy all of them. Not to drum up business as a hard money.
No, it's unfortunate because
it's unfortunate, but I think that's where we're going to be headed to a large degree. I think either that or you have a license and you just overkill on the disclosures and stuff like that, you could probably get it done. Non-licensed, I think it's just going to be so difficult because you're not going to be able to market it that. Because again, it's the force. They want everybody under their umbrella that they can.
I know a broker here. Actually, you know him very well. You're actually working with him on this. But I know he has quite the addendum to wholesale. I mean, it's a book. And I can tell you in Idaho, at least the last time I checked there with the division, so their statutes are very similar to Utah's. However, if you disclose everything,
right.
If you tell the seller, I'm going to make this much money and I'm going to market your property, you're good. If you disclose. It's when you don't disclose that you have potentially a problem.
Yeah, and that's also that's where the fraud comes in. Yeah. When they sniff fraud, that's when they get angry.
Yeah.
And they're going to start being more restrictive on everything else. Whereas if they don't think fraud was involved, that you were just not doing it right, they'll be much more lenient.
Well, and the one thing that I hear all the time, and it doesn't work, and I just want you to, if you say, I'm not going to buy the property, I'm going to market your property, that's good enough to allow you to go market the property. It doesn't give you, I don't care about your equitable interest in the contract. And just because you ask for permission, which isn't bad, I mean, it doesn't hurt, but it doesn't alleviate all the other issues to allow you to go market a property that you do not own.
That you do not own.
Yeah. Okay, so one last thing I want to talk about. Let's talk about your education, what you do, what you offer. And if people want to contact you for hard money, education, legal services, on and on, how to do so.
For phone number is 801-560-2180. The website is 801-560-2180.
Okay.
Talk to Andrea. She's awesome. She'll get you set up with either me or Cody. The website is brailiolaw.com.
Please spell that out.
I will absolutely spell that since it's not spelled the way it sounds. It's BREGLIOLAW.com. Okay. You can always call the number. We can get it to you or send you an email. And it's jeff@brailiolaw.com for an email. But the phone number is usually the easiest. Just 801-560-2180. Call and you know, you can get in touch with me. The website, though, does have a ton of free education. We have essentially an REI education center with a number of older webinars and classes that I've taught that's just free. You can go look at it. We have a store on the page with other educational videos and forms for purchase that you can use. The newest video that we put up is actually on topic. It's called Seller Financing Financing.
Awesome.
It's 3 hours. Goes from basic to seriously complicated, where I walk you through a double wrap where the investor lost money.
Wow.
Because they didn't know how to run the numbers.
Interesting.
So if you're a numbers person and want to understand how mortgages work, amortization schedules, interest rates, terms, and how that all plays into what you're really making on a seller financing deal, check out that video. Awesome. And this fall we'll be doing, we haven't come up with a title, we used to call it summer school because I used to teach a 12-course summer school. With the purchase of a new house, personal residence this summer, I got in a little swamp, so we'll be doing it in the fall. Fall school doesn't sound as snappy as summer school, but it is a 12-course live educational real estate investor educational course we'll be teaching this fall starting in October. You can get information by just calling the office at 520.
This is good for local people, but even outside
absolutely.
Of local, right?
It'll work. Yes, it works locally and nationally. We cover both in the class.
Good.
Like I'll say, here's a Utah rep seeing this kind of things works. And I said, in other states, it might work like this. And so we do both specific and general discussions of legal real estate topics.
Oh, great.
Love it. And you also do title work as well.
I'm an escrow officer, so is Cody. So we do a lot of closings. We seem to always get the crazy seller financing closings. I've seen a ton of them and double wraps. And
they're going to the right people.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, they are. We've got a lot of experience doing it. And closing is really important.
Yeah.
And
we should have talked a little more about that.
Yeah, we probably should have, because especially in seller financing deals, because you know, I'll have that discussion with the investor who may not, because I'll read the documents. I'm like, ooh, you didn't cover this, you didn't cover this, and what about that? And what about the taxes and insurance going up over time? And did you tell that? So they look at a little bit of extra help with a title officer that's experienced in seller financing deals, because they're not traditional.
Right? Yeah.
Your average title officer, there's probably 5 or 6 in town that I would say really understand seller finance closings.
And just a quick testimony, guys, I've used Jeff Braleo for closings, and I've used him for setting up an LLC. He's very good, very professional, very smart guy. So thanks so much, Jeff Braleo, for being on the show. We do have to get you back. Hopefully, in a few months after.
Like I said, usually people can't shut me up. So it's.
Well, and I also would
I didn't cover like 3 questions that we had, so no problem.
Well, and I would also like to, on another episode, dive into disposable LLCs and using trusts in creative financing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because those are very good instruments that everyone should.
And there's
should
some good basic information
of.
On our website on both of those, using trust and disposable LLCs.
Cool.
Well, thanks so much, guys. If you're listening to this, please rate and review our show. We are on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on Spotify, Google Play. We have a website, www.thecreativefinancingpodcast.com. Please go there, leave us a comment, or if you guys want to present a deal and ask us how we would structure it, let us know. We appreciate your ear, and thanks so much, and until next time, create some terms.
Go get a deal.
There you go.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.